Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, a podcast series on the New Books Network. This podcast is for people who want to sail the waters of the expansive Indian Ocean and learn about its past and present. Thank you for joining me today. I'm really excited to share this interview with you. I'm your host, Calvin Ng from Yale University. Miracles and Material Life, Rice, Ore, Traps and Guns in Islamic Malaya by Professor Terence Sevier, published by Cambridge University Press in 2020, is a pioneering book across the fields of South Asian history, Islamic history, and Indian Ocean history. In this groundbreaking new study, Terence Sevier reveals the economic, environmental, and religious significance of Islamic miracle workers, or pawangs, in the 19th and 20th century Malay world. Through close textual analysis of overlooked manuscripts and personal interaction with modern pawangs, readers are introduced to a universe of miracle workers that existed both in the past and in the present, uncovering connections between miracles and material life. Sevier demonstrates how societies in which the production and extraction of natural resources, as well as the uses of technology, were intertwined with the knowledge of charismatic religious figures and locates the roles of the pawangs in the spiritual economy of the Indian Ocean world, across maritime connections and Sufi networks, and on the frontier of the British Empire. Over the course of our conversation, we will talk not just about Professor Terence Sevier's approach to teaching and writing history, but also how he came to this project. What were some of the decisions that he made when assembling a cogent archive of religious life? I will also ask what can Southeast Asian history and Islamic history gain from Indian Ocean world studies. To learn about those issues and more, join us and stay tuned. I hope you enjoyed the book, and I hope you enjoy our conversation as well. Today I'm here to talk to Professor Terence Sevier, the author of the captivating book, Miracles and Material Life, Rice, Ore, Traps and Guns in Islamic Malaya. By discussing this book, we will dive deep to learn about the fine-grained details of religious life in the Malay world, spanning British colonial Malaya to modern-day Malaysia and Singapore. Terence Sevier is a scholar of Islam and Muslim societies in South and Southeast Asia and received his PhD in history from the University of California, Los Angeles. Before joining Harvard Divinity School, he served as assistant professor of South Asian studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Sevier is also the author of a number of book chapters and journal articles pertaining to Indian Ocean networks, Sufi textual traditions, Islamic erotology, and the socio-economic significance of spirits that have been published in journals such as Third World Quarterly and Modern Asian Studies. In addition to this, he is coordinator of a multimedia project entitled The Lighthouses of God, Mapping Sanctity Across the Indian Ocean, which investigates the evolving landscapes of Indian Ocean Islam through photography, film, and GIS technology. Welcome, Terence, to New Books in the Indian Ocean World, and thank you so much for taking the time to talk about your enjoyable book today. So first, can you start us off by saying a few words about yourself? That is, where did you grow up? How did you become interested in the study of religious life? And how did you come to write Miracles and Material Life? How did the idea develop? What the research process was like? What archives you turned to? And how was your writing experience?
Thank you so much, Kelvin, if I may. And it's such a privilege and honor to be here to discuss my work. And I think you've been very, very kind and praised about my text. And I definitely hope it's a readable one. And in terms of your question, so let me try to answer them in the best way I can briefly. In terms of my own background, I actually grew up in the Malay world, and I grew up primarily in Singapore. And one of the things that I would describe my own experiences and how it actually shaped my research project is I often describe it that I often describe the world I grew up in as a universe of miracle workers. Now, this world that I grew up in, I mean, my initial education into these spirit mediums, miracle workers, came very much from going to Malay classes. My Malay teachers, for that matter, were my earliest and some of my finest teachers about this world, this multiverse of spirits, spirit mediums, miracle workers. Beyond that, I mean, beyond the Malay education I had, I mean, very much I was surrounded by people who were very much convinced about the powers of these miracle workers and spirit mediums that I ended up studying at the later stage of life. Now, whether these miracle workers and spirit mediums were followed, were employed, or whether they were scorned, right, by these people, these communities of people that I grew up with, there was no question about the potency of their power. Indeed, I mean, at a very early age, I was introduced to the idea that some of these miracle workers and spirit mediums are much more efficacious than doctors that we might be more familiar going to, for that matter. There was this idea that these spirit mediums and miracle workers were more efficacious healers. At least they didn't deal with they didn't work through methods of biomedicine that actually worked through visible symptoms. These miracle workers and spirit mediums got to the root cause of diseases or problems that the groups of people that I grew up with were familiar with. And that were the spirit causes of these physical and material phenomena that we easily identify. Now, sorry, that might be a long-winded answer to your question about the background I grew up in, but I was just trying to very quickly summarize that I grew up in this world where these miracle workers and spirit mediums were almost ubiquitous and surrounding all of us. Now, unfortunately, I mean, I would say that now, unfortunately, in spite of this world I grew up in, for a long period of time, I bracketed off this world as one of childhood curiosity. And I never actually worked on these spirit mediums and miracle workers, in spite of the prominence. I remember that even as I would leave Singapore for graduate studies, I would constantly be fed stories of these of miracle workers and spirit mediums on the phone or through any contact that I had with friends, be it with relatives in the Malay world, in Singapore, Malaysia, etc. But what eventually happened was I unexpectedly, if I could say that, almost got back into working into these miracle workers when I was involved in one project. I won't elaborate on that and take too much of your time to work on a certain spirit medium and miracle worker in 2007. But that too led to a series of steps. I mean, as a PhD student, I had not intended to work on spirit mediums and miracle workers, but upon going into the archives, I discovered a number of manuscripts that were produced by miracle workers, spirit mediums, pawangs or bomos of the past. And it's this, working through the archives, I discovered more and more manuscripts. And one of the things that I was very privileged to actually have was to be guided by a number of scholars of both Islamic textual traditions and historians of the Malay world, historians of the Indian Ocean, as I actually got down into working on these manuscripts. But beyond that, what I was largely privileged to gain guidance of was as I discovered these manuscripts and started reading these manuscripts on these miracle workers of the past. I mean, what I was privileged to have was the fact that I could actually read a number of these manuscripts with living spirit mediums and miracle workers. Now, much of my work was very much guided and driven by the fact that I sat down with miracle workers, spirit mediums, pawangs, bomos in present parts of the Malay world and actually could read these traditions with them. Now, this was a very, I mean, of course, I could go on about this, but what these this experience of reading this text was very much guided me into understanding how miracles and spirits were always embedded in work, labor, and what I would define in this book as material life. Now, of course, I mean, this was a very humbling experience over the past few years to sit down with these men and women and these spirit mediums and actually engage these traditions with them. And I could, if I elaborate on this, we'll probably take up more time in the interview. So I should probably hold myself and go on to the next question.
Thank you so much for that answer, Taryn, because I definitely think that your personal relationships with these Bomas and Pawangs, and we can definitely talk a lot more about this later, that formed the crux of this book, right? Because at its core, it's really animated and informed by your ethnographic and your close personal correspondence with these Bomos. So I guess that also leads us to our next question, which is, as a historian of Islam and of the Malay world, can you tell us how you became interested in the Indian Ocean world?
Hi, Kelvin. Thank you for your question. And I think I can't take the credit for actually being a scholar of the Indian Ocean world because of the fact that I was. I mean, I got to attribute all this credit for thinking much more oceanically upon my teachers themselves. As I did my graduate studies, I was taught by a number of scholars of Indian Ocean Studies who often pushed me to think much further in terms of this. And beyond that, I mean, I got a credit even thinking oceanically to earlier scholars of Malay textual traditions and Southeast Asianists. So for that matter, I mean, I think compared to many area studies scholars, I mean, Southeast Asianists have often, I believe at least the Southeast Asianists have largely informed my work, think much more oceanically. I mean, I would compare them to scholars of South Asia, for that matter, who have thought much more in terms of the nation state. I think Southeast Asians have always been much more open in terms of these maritime collections. And I think one of the things that I was largely privileged to be guided by was scholars who often kind of drilled into me that the best way to go would be to take the best of the area studies approach of getting down into languages, studying text, etc., and understanding these manuscripts in the best way possible to do them justice. And beyond that, to gain by the guidance of Indian Oceanists who have encouraged me to think in a broader sense and pushed against the artificial boundaries that have been created both geopolitically and historiographically. Now, beyond that, I mean, again, I what else I would say was that I can't take the credit of being an Indian Oceanist or thinking oceanically, that's what I mean, because of the fact that these texts themselves encouraged me to do that. So, I mean, one of the things that I did while reading these manuscripts was to follow what the text often said. So as I studied these texts, the text itself kind of, and the actors that I was trying to study through these texts often were mobile. Now, these texts opened up a world for me of mobile actors, mobile spirits, and mobile traditions. Now, none of these actors, spirits, and traditions that I've studied in these books or the manuscripts were bound by the imposed boundaries that imposed geopolitical boundaries or at times the imposed artificial boundaries that might come up in times in literature. Now, indeed, what was quite striking about this text, if I might say, was that as you pointed out in your wonderful introduction to my work, I mean, Kelvin, that these texts were at times very much about frontiers. And if we think about frontiers, we often don't think of them as those literal worlds that might excite us when we think about the ocean space. But very much these texts were stark reminders that even the frontiers were very much worlds that were cosmopolitan. These were frontiers populated by diverse spirit populations, diverse spirit mediums, etc. And at times, I mean, I'm not going to break down the diverse populations that were populating these frontiers, but richly cosmopolitan frontiers. But what I just want to say is that these texts on frontiers often reminded us that these to think in terms of the connections between various parts of the Indian Ocean world, the South China Sea, the Atlantic, Pacific Oceans, etc. And all I can say is that rather than taking the credit of of thinking oceanically, I would say that I was myself guided to think oceanically by following these texts. I hope that kind of answers your question. Sorry.
Definitely. And readers, this is a really rich text where you have Bawangs who are of Minangkabau, of Tamil, and of South Yemeni origins, just jostling along with, you know, Chinese tin prospectors and British colonial administrators and Malay villages. And it's such a rich text that you really get a sense of the lived everyday cosmopolitanism of these frontiers. And that's to say nothing of, you know, Rama's encounters with Solomon, which I'll leave you, reader, to discover for yourself in this wonderful book. So moving on to our next question, which is the book itself, it addresses a broad range of archival material and thematic concerns in a very succinct 218 pages. Can you share with us how you organized the book chronologically and thematically? So who were the intended primary theoretical interlocutors for this work? And what sort of historiographical intervention did you seek to make?
So thank you, Kelvin. I mean, it's these were richly caught. In one of a better term, richly cosmopolitan frontiers, full of as you said, South Indian miracle workers, spirit mediums of diverse mixed origins. Beyond that, spirits including Islamic prophets, Hindu divinities, etc. And I suspect we're going to be the conversation will lead us to questions in that direction. For the moment, I mean, in terms of your question on the organization of the book, I mean, this is a tough question, because when I set out to study these manuscripts and study these spirit mediums, these miracle workers, I mean, I found a kind of large collection of texts. And I mean, these were pertaining to various issues. I mean, so for the matter, one of the things that I discovered was how these figures that I was concerned about and the traditions I was concerned about pertain not just to the worlds I have studied, where rice production, tin mining, elephant expertise, or the use of weaponry, or the mediation of technologies, but very much about all kinds of issues, be it house building, be it fishing, etc. You know, I had to make a choice to not look at those texts in this book, and very sadly. And when I actually got these materials, in terms of organizing them, I actually ended up doing organizing it in a way of beginning with texts pertaining to agrarian frontiers, pertaining to rice cultivation, forest clearing, and then moving on to the world of mining, be it tin and gold mining, moving on to the world of elephant mediation, hunting and trapping, and then eventually the mediation of technologies. And there I focus primarily on firearms technology. And I've often wondered whether this organization has worked well, and I hope it has, and I hope it comes true. In terms of the historiographical intervention that I hope to make, I mean, and I must say that I say that my work and my research benefits from generations of scholars who have studied Malay textual traditions and scholars who have studied Islamic miracle workers in various parts of the globe. And I hope that following their path, I made some interventions in the direction of studying Sufism, Islam, and Islamic multiverse. And beyond that, just studying how, for the matter, Islam is embedded into material life. And I'll hold my tongue here, because I believe that the following questions I might be able to elaborate on these in the following questions. I mean, thank you.
Thank you so much for that, Taryn. And you're right, because I think that the sort of integration of miracles and material life within a single analytic frame was definitely one of the strongest contributions of the book. But before we move on to that, just a quick question about sources. You know, as historians, what sources, manuscripts, or documents are available to us as historians today on these forms of religious life, and what were the contexts under which the sources you examined were produced? What accounts for their relative neglect in the historiography of Southeast Asian Islam so far? And what implications does this history have for how we as historians think about such categories as Sufism, Islam, or the vernacular today?
Thank you, Kelvin. So I think that's a fascinating question, and I will try to keep it brief and do justice to your question there. And I think in terms of the sources, and I mean, I hope I'm not repeating myself here, is that I think when I set out to look for these sources, these materials are large that I worked with in this book were primarily manuscripts on Islamic theology, praxis, and to appropriate Niall Green's term, religious economies. I mean, these manuscripts that I pulled out in my these manuscripts that I worked on were also manuscripts that have been often called magical manuscripts. I mean, if I say that in inverted commas. Now, I think, as I said, I was following the work of scholars of Malay textual traditions in pulling out these manuscripts, trying to study them, etc. Now, a number of these texts had been, I mean, I believe, neglected for a period of time for being magical texts, right? Full of fantasy, full of folklore. And I mean, these texts might appear to have little to say about socioeconomic, cultural, or environmental history. But one of the arguments I hope to make in this book is actually they're rich sources of those histories. And to answer your question on how these texts were produced, so these texts are themselves divided. I mean, these manuscripts could at times be original manuscripts that were orally transmitted by these miracle workers, spirit mediums, pawangs, bomos, gurus, sheikhs of the past, or they were manuscripts that at times, I mean, occasionally were even written by them. But on the other hand, they could be manuscripts that were copies of the manuscripts that were orally transmitted by these figures. So what I mean by it's a kind of mixed group of manuscripts. Now, what we have at this moment of time, so we have originals, we have originals that were stored in either libraries, be it court libraries, be it shrine libraries of the past. And beyond that, we have copies that were made. So what I mean by copies is that these manuscripts that I've been studying were largely produced in the 19th and early 20th century. Now, there were a number of scholars of Oriental studies. There were a number of colonial administrators who were largely preoccupied with collecting and preserving these manuscripts. And I hold myself for elaborating on the purposes of collecting these manuscripts. But what was often happening was that a number of these scholars and administrators employed scribes to copy these manuscripts for the preservation and collecting of them. So what we have is also copies of these manuscripts that are preserved in European archives. So one of the things that I was, my sources largely preoccupied, my sources came from both the European archives and beyond that, at times going down into shrine libraries, etc., into present-day Malay world and trying to understand this set of materials. Now, your questions are leading me in a direction to, and I if I'm not taking too much time to also to say a couple of things, I believe, in the sense that what was happening here in terms of the copying of these manuscripts, the preserving of the knowledge of these pawangs, the preserving of the traditions of these pawangs, the genealogies, the methods, the techniques of these pawangs, be it by colonial scholars, etc., reminds us that what we often assumed of as vernacular knowledge and also can be the category of the vernacular can be problematized, if I can say in one of a better term. And I mean, of course, please feel free to tell me if you'd like me to elaborate on any part of this world of these sources and how they were collected, how they were produced more, if I'd like to. And I think before I won't get into the content of these manuscripts, because I believe that's going to be something you're going to ask me about in the following questions. Now, in terms of what these texts tell us about their implications for Islam, for that matter, as you asked, I think, I'm a scholar of Sufism and Islamic societies and Islamic textual traditions. And I think that beyond the fact that I think any study of these Malay Islamic textual traditions is another reminder that Southeast Asia Southeast Asian Islamic textual traditions should be studied much more prominently within Islamic studies. I think one of the things that I found very fascinating about these materials and all that is that, again, these texts and these traditions and this world that I was trying to study was very much about Islamic agents that have been neglected primarily, been neglected often within not only historiography of the Malay world, but beyond that, within Islamic studies. Then this takes us into a world of lived experiential Islam and Islam on frontiers, and not an Islam that is theoretical or a prescriptive religion. Now, that's why I was largely preoccupied with this world of miracles and miracle workers. And beyond that, I think as I'll try to elaborate in the following questions as we get into the content of the materials. One of the things that I was really excited about in these materials and these sources was that how miracles were always tied up to materiality. And I think these are the kind of materials, in spite of the fact that they might have been classified as magical at times, that lead us to actually complicate our definitions of religion, Islam, and think much more materially, as a number of religious studies scholars have encouraged us increasingly to think about religion. And I'm sorry, does that answer your question, Kelly?
Yeah, it definitely does. That was such a beautiful, cogent answer. And I think that your point about the need to study Southeast Asian Islam in a much more rigorous manner in Islamic studies is very well taken, because not many people know that the world's largest population of Muslims in the world today, they live in Indonesia, followed by Pakistan and India in South Asia. So I really think that there is a need to really account for this live experiential worlds of Islam as it is lived in the world today. And I think that leads us very nicely to our next question, which is about the protagonist of your book. So could you just briefly tell us about the multiverse in which these Bomos existed, and who else, whether human or non-human, inhabited this multiverse? How did these Bomos mediate between the physical and ghaib worlds? And how does a historian today remain faithful to these expansive worlds? How are we to think about the interactions and references between Malay Muslims and pre-Islamic religions, non-Muslim traditions and divinities, and an emergent Islamic sphere?
So that's a great question, Kelvin. And I to just perhaps sum up what the multiverse that I was preoccupied with this book constituted. The multiverse constituted of humans, non-human animals, vegetation, spirits. As you said, ghaib or unseeable prophets, tutelary divinities, angels, demons, and defined as hantus or shaitan, jinn. This was the multiverse, the multiverse of these texts was leading into. I'll step back from probably getting too much into Sufi cosmology, but just to put it out, and it's important to note, was that what was often referred to in these textual traditions of the past, and I would say of the present, because I have to highlight that I read this text with living miracle workers and spirit mediums who were still operating in material worlds and central to material activities. What was central to this world of these manuscripts and was that the visible bodies of humans and non-human animals, or visible or physical economic activities and physical technologies, had esoteric realities and spirit natures that were more real than their visible forms. So, and in this world where visible bodies, economic activities and technologies had esoteric realities and spirit natures, these pawangs, the spirit mediums, miracle workers, were operating at the interface between these multiple realities. Now, please feel free to probe me further if you like. But there's so much in these manuscripts as you're asking about this world of this multiversal world. There's so much in these manuscripts. I mean, they're full of genealogies at times. So these pawangs, spirit mediums, bomos, gurus, sheikhs have rich genealogies. At times, I mean, some of them some of these manuscripts suggest that these pawangs were preordained to lead communities and mediate material activities at the time of the creation of the Nur Muhammad itself. right? The light of Muhammad, right? And beyond that, some of these genealogies would suggest that these miracle workers, spirit mediums, had longer lineages leading back to figures like Shiva. And Shiva was very prominently put into an Islamic cosmology, right? But what was... Now, these were the genealogies. Beyond that, in this multiversal world of these manuscripts, what was there was be rituals of communication. Now, these texts would compile rituals of communication that these pawangs would undertake with spirits of the frontier at times, or spirits of the rain, spirits of water bodies, actually. And what they would do is that they would propitiate spirits, engage spirits in material activities, mobilize spirits for all kinds of material, socioeconomic activities, and beyond that, threaten spirits that if they did not partake in the socioeconomic activities, they would suffer the violence inflicted by these pawangs or spirit mediums who would mobilize prophets, divinities, including figures like Shiva, Krishna, etc., to punish these malignant spirits who are not partaking in material activities to assist the clients or followers of these pawangs. All right, now, I think your question in terms of Islamic, if I'm reading it right, your question is largely pushing me to think how do we think about this multiversal world of spirits and this world of Islamic prophets and Hindu divinities in terms of Islamic cosmology. And I would say that one of the things that these texts actually were doing very actively was on one hand, they were localizing Islamic prophets in a very distinctly Malay setting. So you'd find a list of prophets, as you mentioned Solomon earlier, down to the prophet King Solomon, down to the prophet Muhammad, localized in a Malay setting. All right, but beyond that, what you would have is an assimilation of divinities, all right, that for the matter, Hindu tutelary divinities into Islamic cosmologies. And lest we start wondering what kind of Islamic cosmology this is, we've been reminded by scholars of Islamic societies that the pre-Islamic traditions were regularly assimilated within Islam, within Islamic societies of the past. And it's only critiques of this, and some historians of Islamic societies have reminded us that there is only reformers who would deprive such an Islamic cosmology that's rich with localized Islamic prophets or non-Muslim divinities. Only the reformers criticizing these traditions would deprive them of their Islamic legitimacy. I hope that kind of answers your question. I'm sorry, I believe I went a bit long. I gave a long-winded and perhaps confounding answer to your very important
question. I think the sense of heterogeneity and the sense of borrowing that you precisely convey really gets at the core of these manuscripts, right? Because even when these manuscripts attempted to portray the relationship between miracle workers and the phenomenology and heterogeneity of labor or the metaphysical bodies of technologies, it's a very sort of complex, complicated relationship that I hope you could elaborate a little bit on as well. Because this leads me very nicely into my following question, which is how does rice planting or shooting, which are seemingly material processes, assume a spiritual dimension in this text? Also, if we turn to manuscripts transmitted by pawangs who were pivotal cult figures for tin and gold miners in Malaya and Sumatra, how do religious life and extractive capitalism come to intersect in the 19th century?
All right. Thank you, Kelvin. And if we could answer your very important question again, I'm doing justice to your question in terms of how materiality and spirituality are coming together in these texts and the world I've been trying to study, is that one thing I would say is that I found in my argument I tried to make in the book was that these textual traditions and the living traditions of miracle workers and spirit mediums that sat in are very strong reminders that Islam was embedded into a phenomenology of rice, ore, traps, and guns. at times, I mean, I was led to even speculate as I read these works and spent actually more than a decade. I mean, since 2007, sitting down with living miracle workers and spirit mediums, I've been very privileged to do that. They often, these traditions of the past and present, led me to even think about things like rice, ore, traps, guns, etc., as technologies as metaphysical objects of the cosmos. And let me speculate about that, because what was happening here was there was fusing of the time and space of prophets and powangs of the past and the phenomenological experiences of peasants, miners, trappers, and shooters in the present. So there was a lot going on in these materials that I just hope I've done justice in studying, actually. Now, in terms of if I go back to your question, I mean, how we see a kind of spirituality being operationalized was what we saw was that, be it in rice cultivation, forest clearing, the use of technology or weapon technology, there's this idea of following a pawang or bomo. And of course, these figures, as I mentioned in the text, were often professional figures, but following them and following these pawangs, bomos, sheikhs, gurus who had elaborate Sufi lineages. So these texts had very vivid, elaborate Islamic genealogies that these figures had. So you were attaching yourself to someone who had an elaborate genealogy. But beyond that, there was beyond the world of devotion and attachment to a figure who had that elaborate genealogy, be it a man or woman, master, there was operationalization of Sufism or operationalization of Islam. What I mean here is that the material activities were often represented and understood by these pawangs as operationalization of Islam and Sufism. So for that matter, I mean, in a chapter of the text, I actually describe, and I hope I've done it appropriately enough and clearly enough, that for that matter, using a technology for that matter, or a weapon technology, was described in these texts as moving through the stages of embodying Sharia, devotion to a Sufi tariqa or path, and being bonded to a Sufi master and guru. So using a technology for that matter was understood during these texts as a form of operationalizing Sufism. And I think you've asked another important question in terms of how these men and women of the past, these pawangs and spirit mediums, Sufi masters for that matter, were engaged in the world of capitalism. And I think you pointed me towards the chapter on mining. I believe that's where your question is leading me to. And I think what I would say is that what is interesting in these mining manuscripts and a number of other manuscripts that I worked with was that what we found was that in this world of Malaya becoming one the largest tin producing space of the globe, for that matter, in this world in which we have learned so much about, I mean, so in this sorry in this world in which Malayan mines were being worked by capitalists, entrepreneurs from various parts of the globe. I mean, we've read in historiography about how Chinese mining entrepreneurs, for that matter, were driving the extraction of mine in these areas. Now, one of the things that I'm trying to do in this chapter is plug these spirit mediums and miracle workers back into the world, because what we find from these manuscripts and European records is that how actively these miracle workers were working with capitalists, being employed by capitalists to go into mines, to prospect for ore, to extract ore. And beyond that, I mean, since you are asking an important question about extractive capitalism, what was happening in these mines were these miracle workers were imposing a system of law, be it a hukum pawang, it was described by some colonial scholars, or be it a form of sharia, it would be described by some pawangs of the past and present. So they're imposing a form of law in these mines where they were regulating the conduct of miners, ensuring that labor proceeded, all right, banning certain substances from coming to mine, down to regulating the sexual behavior and conduct of these miners in the mine, and cultivating proper forms proper norms of comportment in the mine to ensure that labor and extraction continued. I hope that did some justice to your question, Calvin.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that that definitely brings us to the next question, which is what remains of these diverse life worlds today? Because throughout your fieldwork, what can you conclude about the continued relevance and vibrancy of Bomos today, especially when they're responding to an age of neoliberal capital and an age of, you know, rising authoritarianisms? How have they responded to these crises in the world through their own sort of cosmologies?
Thank you, Calvin. That's a difficult question, because on one hand, I think, like, if I might just draw you into the conversation, I think with you also well aware of the fact that a number of shrines, cemeteries, burial grounds where a number of these Bomos, Pawangs are often visited to commemorate the Pawangs and Bomos of the past have been destroyed in places like Malaysia and Singapore over the past few decades. And I think one of the painful parts of this book was, as I said, I mean, I read a number of these textual traditions of the past with living Pawangs, Bomos, Gurus in the Malay world. And in Malaysia and Singapore, I think one of the painful parts was actually dealing with the loss. I mean, one of the painful parts was sitting with these figures who were often dealing with the loss of cemeteries, of past Pawangs, Bomos that were being demolished over the past few decades. Now, nevertheless, I do want to point out here that Bomos of the past, Pawangs of the past and the present have always been versatile. So lest we assume that we're going to be operating within, lest we assume that they're operating within, in one of a better term, exotic locations like cemeteries, burial grounds, shrines, would be limestone hills, wherever, you know, they're highly versatile. I mean, a number of these miracle workers of the past, miracle workers that I met in the Malay world were operating in all kinds of diverse spaces, be it coffee shops down to offices, etc. Now I would say that in spite of the fact that we are seeing we have seen an encroachment on spaces of congregation or spaces of commemorating past Pawangs, we have seen and a number of scholars have written about how at least within Malaya and Malaysia, we've seen an increasing bureaucratization and what, to borrow the words of William Brough, institutional Islamization of Islam since the late 19th century. I mean, one of the things that we do see is that these spirit mediums, Bomos, miracle workers are still actively participating in the world. I did describe that I grew up in a world that I felt was a universe of these figures, and I still do know various Pawangs and Bomos who are operating very actively in this world. And I think in the past and the present, Pawangs, Bomos, let alone we assume that there's a fraternity of spirit mediums, miracle workers, let us assume there's a Sufi fraternity out there. There have been competitions between these groups. And as in the past, in the present, we find certain miracle workers being much more prominent at a certain moment of time and competing, while others are competing with their rivals to actually move up their rank of prominence. I'm answering your question accurately, but like as in the past and in present, I would say that these miracle workers, spirit mediums, continue to combine multiple roles. Now, what I mean by multiple roles is that they operate as healers, they operate as Sufi masters, they operate as miracle workers, they operate as astrologers, they operate as seers, etc. So they combine multiple roles at times, and some of them might play certain roles more than others. This ensures the kind of versatility in the world. Now, in terms of in their understanding of their activities, of course, as I spoke to many of these miracle workers, not only were they disturbed by the encroachment upon spaces for that matter, but they were also disturbed by what they would often lump very very loosely, I would say, as Wahhabism or attack of scripturalists, be it Salafis, be it Wahhabis, that this attack upon their activities and their space. Now, they were actively conscious of the fact that they were being their activities were being increasingly regulated, in spite of the fact that I found many of them thriving in their activities. Now, why I say that I use these categories loosely was, as I said, debates between these miracle workers and competitions were as prominent in the past as in the present. Now, a number of these miracle workers will attack each other also, all right, and challenge their rivals in the sphere. Now, but not to get too much into that, but in terms of your question of how they're conceiving of themselves in their own world, I think one of the things that has emerged with this increasing consciousness that they're feeling threatened institutionally or by groups that they loosely classify as Wahhabi or Salafi, is that some of these miracle workers have felt threatened and stopped using certain appellations, at least in public. So some of the figures I knew, at least at the start of my research, would be comfortable with certain appellations such as Bomo, have increasingly stopped using such appellations in want of what they are being conceived of. And I use this inverted commas, more Islamic appellations. That's probably a very long, confusing answer to a very important question. So I'll stop myself there.
No, thank you so much for that. And I think that sort of is emblematic of the contemporary transformations of religious life as well. And I think that further underscores the import and urgency of your work in really sort of foregrounding and highlighting a world of diverse cosmopolitan religious orientations and engagements that, you know, seem starkly different from the world that we inhabit today. So before we move on to our last traditional question, can you please read a paragraph from the book?
Thank you, Kelvin. And I think I will read a paragraph that would tie up with your earlier question, because one of the things that to show the versatility of these men and women in the present is the fact that I often met some of these Pawangs and Bomos in spaces that I had not expected to. And this is probably coming from my own limitations of understanding the Pawangs and Bomos. So I will read this paragraph, which I hope is fine. And I should mention that I might just paraphrase the paragraph from the book to just mm-hmm. translate some of the words that are non-English words, if that's fine.
Of course.
Although I was primarily preoccupied with textual analysis, my fieldwork led me to discover widespread paideas of Bomos across the Indian Ocean and beyond. For example, while inquiring about Sufi networks in Philadelphia in September 2017, I met three self-professed Bomos of African-American origins who had lived in Pahang, Pera, and Aceh. They stayed in Sufi lodges and were initiated into branches of the Qadiri and Naqshbandi tariqas, where they acquired the ilmu of healing and mediating American guns and bullets while practicing Malay Islamic martial arts. Salat. These Bomos had returned to the United States to initiate other Muslim and non-Muslim devotees into their Sufi pathways and to serve as semi-professional spirit mediums, healers, and martial arts gurus. They described their return as being in line with other Pawangs of the past who healed societies plagued by epidemics and calamities. In their words, they had returned at an opportune time, just when they were needed to restore the spiritual and material health of a society suffering from a new pathology of penyakit, Trump. Like all the Pawangs I met, these American Bomos reminded me that all aspects of the visible world were connected to the unseen. Material life, economic production, extraction of resources, uses of technology, inclement weather, and even political elections, examples being Brexit, Trump, were intertwined with the ilmu and charismatic religious authority of miracle workers. Thank you.
Beautiful. Thank you so much. Well, Taryn, we've taken up a lot of your time, so by way of conclusion, can you tell us what you're working on now and a little bit about your current and future projects?
Oh, thank you, Kelvin. You haven't taken up much of my time. It's such a pleasure. I would just very briefly say that I'm working on two projects at the moment. And I've been working on a series of articles on shrines and Sufi masters in Batavia, Rangoon in Singapore. But I am currently working on two larger projects, one of which is a work on animal Islam, on Malay manuscripts on animals. So particularly, it's something that has come up from this earlier project on Malay manuscripts and these miracle workers. I found a corpus of manuscripts on animals and animality itself. So I'm taking it. I'm working on that. But my other project that I'm really excited about, and I hope is of interest to other scholars, is a work that I've been some preoccupied with over the last few years on Singapore Islam. So clearly, it's very influenced by the works of scholars working on Indian Ocean port cities, etc., including the works of scholars on Indian Ocean port cities, and I'm largely studying how Singapore, for that matter, was a center of global Sufism in between the period of the late 19th and early 20th century.
And they're really exciting, and I'll definitely be looking out for them. But for now, thank you so much for joining us on our podcast today. And thank you, listeners, for listening to today's episode, in which we explored Miracles in Material Life by Professor Terence Sevier, published by Cambridge University Press in 2020. You can find the book on bookstore or other outlets. This is your host, Calvin Ng. Stay tuned for the next episode of New Books in the Indian Ocean World.